We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Venezuela's simmering political crisis is starting to boil over after opposition leader Juan Guaido called on the country's military and citizens to support him in overthrowing President Nicolas Maduro. That's led to some dramatic confrontations. But now Maduro claims that the coup has been put down. Joining The Crisis Next Door to make sense of what's going on in Venezuela is Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Dr. Ottolenghi focuses on Hezbollah's Latin America operations. Dr. Ottolenghi, thank you for joining The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you for having me.
Venezuela has been teetering on a precipice since Guaido declared himself president on January 23rd, receiving recognition from the U.S. and dozens of other countries. Why do you think he's making this move now, and how big of a risk is it?
Juan Guaido proclaimed himself president on January 23rd in accordance to the tenets of the Venezuelan constitution. One thing you have to give to the Venezuelan opposition to Maduro is that they have tried in every which possible way to bring the country back from the brink and restore democracy by following the dictates of the law and by doing so peacefully and democratically. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked until now because, despite the fact that Guaido has the majority, vast majority of the National Assembly, the elected parliament in Venezuela, on his side, he has the constitution on his side, and he has been recognized by 54 countries led by the United States, the illegitimate regime of Nicolas Maduro has basically dug in and refuses to budge. And because Maduro controls the security apparatus and has the loyalty of the army, we have been seeing basically a stalemate in the past 4 months, while the economic humanitarian situation gets worse. So I think that because of that, and possibly because, according certainly to reports that were circulated yesterday, Guaido's arrest was imminent, I think that he decided to make this move. And clearly, he didn't decide to make this move just because it was a gamble, but likely because he and the opposition have had talks with the security apparatus, with interlocutors in the armed forces, and they felt that they had enough support within the security apparatus to try and oust Maduro.
Now, the military is key to Guaido's gambit here, and he was flanked by military supporters in his call to overthrow Maduro, but the generals are still publicly supporting Maduro. Is the support not there for Guaido in the armed forces, and without enough support of the military, does Guaido have any chance at all at continuing his opposition?
Well, it's very hard to tell. The army rank and file is obviously the bulk and the backbone of the force, and is not necessarily committed either way. I'm sure you will find the army divided, but the higher ranks of the army, the command structure, of course, has a lot to lose by letting go of Maduro, because the army has been very much engaged and complicit with the regime's illicit financial activities, facilitating the drug traffic, racketeering the supplies of food and commodities and basic commodities, using that as a political pressure tool to force people into obedience and the opposition into silence. So there is a lot to lose for many of these people, and so that may account for the resilience of the high-ranking officers' loyalty to Maduro. There's also the fact, well-known fact, that Cuban military advisors, so-called, have heavily infiltrated the army, and so there may be, you know, enough secret police monitoring those who might want to defect and making it harder for them to do so. So it's a very complex situation, but I think that on the bright side of things, despite the fact that Maduro still controls, by and large, the security apparatus, despite the fact that he still has physical control over much of the, the buildings of power, and the levers of power, the bureaucracy, and so on, Guaido hasn't been touched. Every time Guaido and the opposition step up and escalate this confrontation, it's one more dent in the regime. So this may not be something that happens overnight or in the next few days, but I think that in the long term, Maduro's prospects are becoming increasingly less tenable.
There was dramatic video of an armored personnel carrier running over some of Guaido's supporters in the first day of protests. And while Maduro is talking a tough game, how does he balance his crackdown from too far to not enough to protect his backside?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do because, of course, if Maduro decides and his forces decide to escalate the violence, and you have significant casualties on the street, if the incident we've seen on social media yesterday of that armored truck running over, peaceful and armed protesters, if those incidents multiply, that might actually trigger the opposite of what Maduro wants to achieve, right? That the opposition becomes more determined, that there is more resolve, and also that there may be cracks within the army, because don't forget, a lot of the families of the rank and file who are in uniform, well, their families may be among the protesters. So, as people come back home from putting down a protest and discover that their loved ones are in jail or hurt or worse, that too undermines Maduro. So he has to be very careful not to escalate. On the other hand, if they don't respond with violence, the opposition will be emboldened, and they risk getting the opposite, of course, that they're gonna lose control of the situation. So that's why I think that in the long term, the prospects for the opposition are better. It's paradoxically, despite the fact that Maduro holds the stick and has the security apparatus still largely intact and loyal to him, the options he has are not so good.
We've seen the use of paramilitary groups by Maduro's government in the past against opposition groups in Venezuela. Might he rely on those groups in cracking down on the protesters, or perhaps use the Cuban advisors that are within the military to handle that kind of work?
I think increasingly so. I mean, again, sort of as things progress, the loyalty of the army and the willingness of the rank and file to follow such harsh orders may increasingly come into question. And so the only way to ensure that protests can be dispersed and the opposition can be beaten up without the risk of losing control has to rely on the paramilitary groups, the militias, and the outside advisors, who of course are there at the behest of foreign governments, who have every interest in keeping Maduro in power.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the uprising in Venezuela with Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says Maduro was ready to flee to Cuba after Guaido's call to overthrow him, but was talked into staying by Russia. How big of a key is Venezuela for Russia when it comes to countering U.S. geopolitical power?
You know, it's like a thorn on the side of the United States to have the Russians there, and the Russians know it, and that's why they're there. But remember, the Russians also have another issue with Venezuela, and that is that they have poured tens of billions of dollars into the Venezuelan economy to keep it afloat and to keep the regime in power. So, you know, they're, at the end of the day, it's not just about the geopolitical implications of having an ally in the Western hemisphere, in the sphere of influence of the United States, that they can use to annoy to annoy the United States and to push back and try to diminish American influence in the area. It's also about the money. And they're very aware in Moscow that it's not going to be easy to recoup all those tens of billions of dollars, that the economy is it's on its knees. You don't even have the technology in place anymore to plunder the country's resources. And part of the reason why Venezuela's oil output has plunged is not the sanctions. It's the degradation of the infrastructure and, frankly, the loss of human capital as scores of qualified engineers have left the country in order to be able to feed their families and washed up, working as gardeners or construction workers in Florida or in Lima, Peru. And so, the Russians must be aware of this thing and must realize that at some point, if they want to cut some of their financial losses, they need to work out a compromise with the United States.
We're also seeing China help out in Venezuela as Caracas deals with crushing U.S. sanctions and seeing the economy just devastated, rolling blackouts on a widespread basis. How big is China's investment in Venezuela?
Just as significant as the Russian is, although, the Chinese approach is slightly different. They go into this country with a typical neocolonialist mentality. They want to acquire strategic assets in Latin America, not just in Venezuela. They've been busy for the last decade or so buying land, agricultural land, for example, so that they can leverage that for their food needs. They want to access strategic assets like ports and infrastructure, critical infrastructure, for the same reason, and also to leverage their influence. So it's a slightly different calculation for them, but I think that bottom line is not so different than the one made in Moscow. And again, the Chinese must be aware if they keep backing Maduro and then Maduro goes, they will lose it all. So at some point, as Maduro's position becomes more tenuous, there may be leverage for Washington with the Chinese as well to work out a compromise.
Dr. Otto Lange, you've tracked Hezbollah's movements in Latin America, and you authored a recent paper on the influence that Hezbollah backer Iran is having in Venezuela with the return of Aeroterror. What is Aeroterror, and how critical is that relationship between Tehran and Caracas?
So in 2007, when Hugo Chavez was the president of Venezuela and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was the president of Iran, the two presidents worked out an agreement whereby Venezuelan carrier, national carrier, Conviasa, would fly to Tehran on a weekly basis. The aircraft would typically fly to Damascus, actually, make a stopover and then continue on to Tehran. And that flight, which went on for at least 3 years, was anything but a commercial flight, despite the fact that it was operated by a commercial airline. It was only open to officials, and the two governments used it to move money, drugs, weapons, and intelligence and military personnel back and forth. So it really wasn't something designed to develop tourism and commerce, but it was designed to serve illicit purposes. The flight eventually came to an end, and it's not clear to this day why it couldn't be sustained. But whatever the case, you know, recently the Iranian airline Mahan Air has flown direct from Tehran to Caracas to negotiate the reopening of the route. And Mahan Air is the same airline that carried the Shia militias from Iran to Syria to help Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad stay in power. So, of course, there is a concern that air of terror, the, you know, the flight that sustains terrorist activities, could actually have been put in place again to help Maduro stay in power at whatever the cost.
Has there been any reports yet of Hezbollah activities in Venezuela or Iran's Revolutionary Guard showing up yet?
So, you know, Iran and Hezbollah actually have a well-established and extensive infrastructure in Venezuela, have had it for at least over a decade. But by and large, that infrastructure served the purposes for Iran of evading U.S. and international sanctions at the height of the sanctions regime, and for Hezbollah as a venue for money laundering of drug proceeds, and that infrastructure is very much intact and still active. Now, of course, once you have that infrastructure and agents running it, you can use that also for operatives who come into the country for different and more nefarious purposes. So it's very possible that at this very moment, as we're speaking, the Iranians are quietly moving assets into the country that could be leveraged to support Maduro. It's just that until now, that's something that's been left mostly to the Cubans to do. And I think for obvious reasons, it makes a lot more sense given, you know, geographic proximity, that it would be Cuba to take, to do most of the heavy lifting in counterintelligence, in military terms, to prop up the regime.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says military action is possible in Venezuela. How likely is that, given Maduro's support from Russia and China?
Again, Russia has, provided military supplies to Venezuela. And so there have been, Russian personnel on the ground to train the Venezuelan armed forces. But we're talking about small things. So we're not talking, Venezuela is not the Ukraine the breakaway republics in the Caucasus in Georgia. This is far away from Russia. Now, of course, an escalation of that kind would increase tensions dramatically, because the Russians and the Chinese have interests in Venezuela they want to protect. But I would like to point out that even if we got to the point where the only way to protect the opposition and to ensure transition to the restoration of democracy was by exerting some sort of military pressure on the Maduro regime, I would hope that the United States can play an advisory role to regional allies, because ultimately this is a Latin American country fomenting a regional crisis because of the humanitarian catastrophe that the regime has imposed on its own people. There are millions of Venezuelan refugees in neighboring countries, in Brazil, in Colombia, and beyond, in Peru, and all the way down to Argentina and Chile. And I would hope that it is the local regional governments, who have been very vocal until now in support of Juan Guaido, that step up to the plate if there was a military operation to be had, rather than always waiting for Uncle Sam to deliver, only to be criticized later on for imperialistic tendencies.
Colombia is calling on Maduro to step down. You've got Bolivia supporting Maduro. Do you think that we could see a potential civil war in Venezuela spread into a broader regional conflict in South America?
Well, first of all, we already are seeing the harbingers of a civil war in Venezuela. I mean, it's actually remarkable that the opposition has not resorted to violence yet. Latin America typically is not a a place where it's so difficult to obtain weapons if you want to. And so it's remarkable that they have managed to keep their operation peaceful. It's really hard to tell whether this could degenerate into something bigger. But I'm glad you mentioned Bolivia, because, as you know, the Trump administration, in its frequent rhetorical expressions of disapproval and contempt for Venezuela and its allies, has spoken of a troika of aggression and of tyranny in the region, mentioning Cuba and Nicaragua as the principal allies of Maduro and the two countries that have propped up Maduro and its regime more than anyone else. And one should not forget that Bolivia, too, is a narco state like Venezuela, is a state that has been complicit with Venezuela, that has been a partner to Maduro, that is a partner to the Iranians, and that has, discarded all vestiges of respect for the principles of the rule of law, democracy, transparency, free and fair elections. And we should not forget that Bolivia, too, deserves better than to have somebody like Evo Morales continue to plunder its coffers, facilitate narco-trafficking at the expense of the region, while spewing anti-Americanism as a cover for his crimes.
And the region holds its breath as it watches the events unfold in Venezuela. Dr. Ottolenghi, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.